It is June the 2nd, we are in Yechezkel, in Perek Mem Vav, which is chapter 46, Pasuk Ches, verse 8. We've been dealing with the karbonos, the sacrifices that are offered in the Beis HaMikdash, seemingly to inaugurate the third Beis HaMikdash, and we've been dealing with the Nasi, and we said there are two opinions who this Nasi is. Nasi means prince, whether it is referring to the Kohen Gadol or whether it is referring to the king. And now, we'll be discussing some of the particulars of the Nasi and where he goes when he comes to the Beis HaMikdash. We already read in the beginning of this chapter that there is a particular gate that is not opened the whole week. We read this back in Pasuk Aleph in verse 1. And then on Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh, it is opened up, and that's where the Nasi stands and offers his sacrifices. And people then pass by and bow at that gate. They leave the gate open for others to bow at that gate.
To Hashem or to the Nasi?
No, to Hashem. To Hashem.
That's where he cooks the sacrifice, or he slaughters the sacrifice.
Well, it seems that that's where he watches the Kohanim offer his sacrifice. But you're bringing up a good point. If you'll hold the place here and go back to Perek Mem Dal, chapter 44, all the way to the beginning of that chapter. So there as well, there is a discussion about a particular gate that is kept closed. That is a gate that is kept closed in Perek Mem Dal, chapter 44, Psukim Aleph and Beis 1 and 2. Discusses this gate that is kept closed, and it's only for Hashem to go through, whatever that means.
Is that the golden gates?
What's that?
Is that the golden gates?
No. Well, we're not sure. I mean, I'll point on the map what it could be in a moment.
But it's the southern.
Hold on. And then in Pasuk Gimel back there, in verse 3. In Perek Mem Dal, chapter 44, it says, the Nasi will sit there to eat his bread in front of Hashem. So, the Medrash seems to link that discussion about a particular gate which is kept closed, and the Nasi sits in it, and it's a gate that's for Hashem, whatever that means, and that the Nasi sits there to eat his bread. The Medrash links that with the beginning of this chapter, which we read last week, about this gate that is opened up for the Nasi, that the whole week it's kept closed, and on Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh it's opened up, and they bow in that gate. So there is a difference of opinion what gate we're talking about. Where is it? As I said, also there's a discussion of who the Nasi is. So Rashi understands, at least he seems to understand, and it's really very, very obscure. We know that it's got to be, it has to have something to do with the south, because it mentions the south gate. And it says east.
It says it faces eastward.
Right, it says it faces eastward.
Would that mean like it's western gate facing eastward?
So hold on. Let's get
in. No western gate.
In Perek Mem Vav, in chapter 46, in the first three verses, it does not tell you which gate. It doesn't give you a direction. It just talks about the inner gate. No, I'm sorry. There it says facing east. There it does say facing east. The inner gate facing east. In Perek Mem Dal, chapter 44, in the beginning, there it says the southern.
No, it says
eastward. Mm-hmm. It says, hold on, take a look.
The outer gate which faces eastward.
Right, right.
Closed.
That's true. Hold on.
What's a wicket?
No, wicket is
kind of wicket.
It's a kind of a small, narrow gate between two.
Yeah, you're right.
Gates.
It does say eastern over there also.
Like a narrow door in the gate.
Thank you.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So now, so it definitely has to be something on the east, and we'll see. We'll see. Really, it's clearly something in the east. As we go further, starting from Pasuk Ches, starting from verse 8, which is tonight's part that we're going to learn. Now, if you're talking about something in the east, some kind of east gate, you have several choices. You have the eastern gate to the outer courtyard. That's down here. You have the eastern gate to the inner courtyard. And then you have any of these gates going into the actual sanctuary. Rashi understands that the gate we're talking about, as you said, wicket, whatever that is the southern little gate that is adjacent to the large entrance to the sanctuary. This area right here. That there's a gate over there, which is normally kept closed. It's the southern side of the eastern entrance to the sanctuary. There is only an eastern entrance to the sanctuary. And that there, it's normally kept closed. And the Nasi eats his bread there. Bread over there means eats whatever he's supposed to eat, his meat, whatever it is. Now there are some difficulties saying that this is what it's talking about. Number one is that although it is not 100% clear where the common people were allowed to walk in the third Beis Hamikdash and where only Kohanim could go. But if we are to follow the formula that we know from the second Beis HaMikdash, if we're to follow that formula, then non-Kohanim could only go in the outer courtyard, and then in the inner courtyard only up until the demarcation line over here. And that would be it. The non-Kohanim would not be allowed to go past the demarcation line, nor of course would they be able, of course they would not be able to go all the way into the sanctuary area. Only Kohanim could go. So if we are to say that we're referring to this little gate here, we would have to say, first of all, the Nasi does not refer to the king. It has to refer to the Kohen Gadol, ostensibly, meaning I'm making an assumption that in the third Beis HaMikdash, the same rules of who's allowed to walk where will apply as in the second Beis HaMikdash. The king is not allowed to go where the Kohanim, where only Kohanim could go, because the king is not a Kohen. The king can't be a Kohen. The king must be from Yehuda, not from Levi. So, therefore, it would seem to preclude the Nasi being the king if we're talking about this entrance. It would have to be the Nasi's referring to the Kohen Gadol, which is okay. Rashi does mention the Kohen Gadol. The other difficulty with this way of understanding it is that the Pasuk makes it clear that they would leave the gate open so that the Am Haaretz, the people of the land, meaning the Jewish people, as they walk past that gate, can bow to God, since that gate is meant to be the gate of the divine presence, whatever that means. But if the gate is all the way over here, you're not going to have too many people who can possibly walk past it, because only Kohanim can walk over there, and even then, how many Kohanim are actually walking in this area? How many Kohanim are actually walking?
It's the pomegranate.
There was a discussion why the custom is to put bells on a Torah scroll. There's a discussion about it. Some say the reason is so you can hear it coming, so you know to stand up.
Was that a
Torah scroll? Yes, but I realized that you didn't know, which is why I didn't say anything, because if you don't know, you don't have to go. And I was already standing.
Now we know.
So it makes it a little bit difficult to understand the idea of people passing by and bowing. Now, the alternative is that it's not referring to this gate, but rather it's referring to the eastern gate to the inner courtyard. If that's the case, then it would mean that there is some place over here that is special for the Nasi, in which case the Nasi could either mean the Kohen Gadol or it could mean the king, and that normally the gate would be kept closed and that no one would use it, meaning that normally it would be the northern and southern gates that were used, not the eastern gate. Now, why would that be? We're going to see presently why that would be. And therefore, only the Nasi would use the gate, and they would open it for him. And on Rosh Chodesh, and on Shabbos they would leave it open so that the people who would pass by would bow in that direction, because that would be where the Divine Presence would reside. Now that would also make a lot of sense for saying that's where the Divine Presence would reside, because this gate faces directly into the Kodesh HaKadosh. Even though you can't see all the way through, but you're on the correct path to the Kodesh HaKadosh. If you bow towards this gate or towards this gate, you're not bowing towards the Kodesh HaKadoshim, towards the Holy of Holies. If you're bowing here, then you're bowing all the way to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So it would make sense that they leave it open and people pass by and they bow as they pass by. That would explain this gate here. But as I said, Rashi does not understand that. Rashi understands it being this gate over here. Yeah?
I thought they were only supposed to eat in the chambers.
Okay, so they eat in the chambers because it's a private place to eat. So if this gate is normally kept closed, then no one's there. The traffic
just
is all
in the gate area.
Right. It would be all the way on the inside over here. The traffic is all going this way. No one is coming in over here if it's normally kept closed.
But if the inner court, if they can only go so far into the inner courtyard, how do they get there from the northern and southern gates?
I mean, how do they ever get to here? That's a good question.
They'd have to go all the way around.
No, but they wouldn't. If this is kept closed, they can't get in that way.
If that's kept closed, they can't get into that area, and that's where they're going.
That's a good point. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Remember, this is all an approximation. We don't know if there's paths or other types of things. Remember, even the existence of these two chambers is in question. We don't even know if they exist. That's one opinion, that there are chambers here. There's another opinion that there are no chambers here, just these two. So it's all an approximation, but you bring up a good point. That it would seem that there has to be a way to get in this way. Right. That's a good point. At any rate, there is some gate which is normally kept closed on the eastern side, which is opened on Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh for the Nasi, and they leave it open for others to pass by and bow. The Medrash says that this eastern gate, whichever gate we're talking about, would be kept closed the entire week. It would open by itself when Shabbos started, and it would open by itself when the new moon appeared. It would be an indication to the people that Shabbos has begun. It would be the indication to people that Rosh Chodesh has begun. It would be the you wouldn't need to have witnesses. You wouldn't need to have a siren tell you when Shabbos. Right here, it would just open up, and then you would know Shabbos has begun. So, and it was a nace, or I should say was, it will be a nace that will take place that will tell us when Shabbos is and when Rosh Chodesh is. So again, which gate we're talking about, I'm not sure. If it is this gate, it would be a gate that everybody could see. If it's this gate, it's hard to understand because people wouldn't be able to see it. It would be very difficult to see. Unless there are different rules for where you're allowed to walk, which I don't know about that. So it becomes a little bit difficult. Yeah.
Why would you have the Kohen Gadol coming in from some other place?
Okay, good. Okay, so we're going to see, let's go further now. We'll see the difference between the Kohen Gadol's movements in the Beis HaMikdash or whoever the Nasi is, whether it's Kohen Gadol or the Melech, and everybody else. And we'll see about that. Yeah.
So this is just an awareness that I thought. So when we go and pray by the wall, we're actually the closest to the Holy of Holies.
Yes. Yeah. Or as we've pointed out before, when you go to the wall, you're actually standing out. This is not the same wall because this is the third base of English, but you're standing over here,
right,
facing this way.
Right.
Facing
and
west.
It's closest to the Holy of Holies.
Right. It's behind the Holy of Holies. We're facing the opposite direction.
Right.
That would be faced if we were inside the Beis HaMikdash.
Right. But it's actually the closest spot you could get to of the holiest place of the whole universe.
Yeah. Yeah. That is why there are those who argue, there are different opinions. That is why there are those who say not to put one's hand into the crevices of the wall. Because where does the Kedusha, where does the sanctity begin? It's common practice to take a kvittel and put it in the wall. But there are those who say not to do that because we don't know exactly where the sanctity begins. And since we are all impure today, because we do not have the parah adumah, we don't have the red heifer to become pure, therefore one should be careful not to touch or approach or the wall in that way. So different opinions. There are plenty of opinions to say that it's okay, and if you've done it before, you don't have to worry about it. There's plenty what to rely on to do that. But you may hear someone say, "Don't get so close to the wall." That's the reason why, because it's not clear exactly where does the sanctity begin. Pasachas verse 8. Uvevo ha-nasi, when the nasi shall come, again, we don't know whether this is the Kohen Gadol or the king. Derech ulam ha-shar yavo, he will come through the way of the entrance hall of the gate. Uvidarko yetse, and he will go out the same way he came in. He will enter and exit through the same gate. Uvevo am haaretz lifnei Hashem, but when the people of the land, which means the rest of the Jewish people, come in front of God, b'moadim, on the holidays, haba derech shar tzafon, the one who comes through the northern gate, lishdachavos to bow, yeitze derech shar negev, shall go out the way of the southern gate. Ve'haba derech shar negev, the one who comes through the gate, the southern gate, yeitze derech shar tzafona, shall go out going through the northern gate. Lo yashuv derech hashar asher bavo, he shall not return through the gate through which he came. Ki necho yetze, rather he will go out opposite the one that he came in. V'hanasi, and the nasi, b'socham b'voam yavo uv'teisam yetzeu. That the nasi, with them, amongst them, meaning when he comes with them, with everybody else, rather than when he comes by himself. We just said before, when he comes by himself, he goes in and comes out the same gate. But when he comes with the rest of them, with everybody else, then he should go in with them and go out with them. So then he would also go in one gate and go out the other gate when he's going along with everybody else. Uvachagim uvamoadim. Let's stop here and explain this, and then we'll read on. So what we've read then is that the Nasi goes in and comes out the same gate, while everybody else goes in one gate, comes out the other gate. On a holiday when the Nasi as well is going with the people, then he also should do like they do, which is go in one gate and come out the other gate.
Makes sense then that it should be that eastern gate, because the other gates have an opposing gate.
Okay, exactly. Okay, so everybody else, they go in one gate and come out the other gate. Again, it's unclear whether we're talking about the gate to the outer courtyard or the gate to the inner courtyard. Where it's not clear. But whichever one we mean, when they come in from the north, they should go out through the south. If they come in through the south, they go out through the north. The Nasi, when he's not with everybody else, he's coming in by himself, then he enters through the east and exits through the east. He does not need to go through one entrance and come out the other one. The Nasi, therefore, uses the eastern gate, because the eastern one, as was just pointed out, the eastern one does not have a corresponding gate. But on the holidays, when it is a very trafficked time in the Beis HaMikdash, because on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, every able-bodied male over Bar Mitzvah must come to the Beis HaMikdash, unless a person is sick or too old. Any able-bodied male must come to the Beis HaMikdash. There are no exceptions to that. Women and children could stay at home, but as you would imagine, if the men are traveling for Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, usually their families came along. So that the Yerushalayim was
packed,
right? Wall to wall packed with people on the holidays, and the Beis HaMikdash became a very, very heavy trafficked area on the holidays.
Great time to sell fruit.
Okay. And Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, even though there is no obligation to come to the Beis HaMikdash on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but a lot of people did it because it's the high holidays. So people would want to come there, especially to see the special avodah, the special service of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, which we read about in Musaf. That was a sight to see. People would want to come see it. On Pesach, it was, of course, the most traffic time, because then there's not only an obligation on men, there's an obligation on women as well, because the women also have to eat of the Karban Pesach. So on Pesach, at least the first day of Pesach, was the most busy time of the Beis HaMikdash, and everybody had to be there. And once the men and women are coming, what do you do with the children? You've got to bring them as well. So it becomes a very, very packed area. And so on the holidays, when it was very, very busy, then the Nasi would do like everybody else, which is come in one entrance and exit the corresponding one, or vice versa, but not through the eastern one. Now, we still have to explain why is it that typically the everybody else has to go in one and out the other, while the Nasi does not. So we'll get to that in a moment. Yeah.
Okay, just me with my flow ideas here. It seems awkward. Let's say you're preparing your animal in the northern outer courtyard, right?
Okay.
And then the Kohen moves it to the ramp, so going all the way around, and then going up, and you're seeing it, and then you leave, you know, like the flow doesn't seem right.
The animal is slaughtered in the inner courtyard.
So it can't be in the southern part of the inner courtyard? It was always in the northern part?
Assuming that we follow, again, we're extrapolating from the second Beis HaMikdash to the third Beis HaMikdash, because we don't really know. But assuming it's going to follow the same rules, then the slaughtering would be done in the inner courtyard, most of the time in the north.
So why wouldn't the ramp be facing that side?
No, that was true in the second Beis HaMikdash also. The ramp was here, the slaughtering was here.
But why? The flow doesn't seem right.
Yeah, that's the way, that's already in the Torah itself. That's the way it's
but
supposed to be set up.
But do we know why? I mean, there's got to be a specific reason, because it kind of goes against the flow.
But there's got to be a reason.
We don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is. That doesn't mean we don't know. I don't know what it is. But that is the way, there are certain, not every carbon, but some carbonos have to be slaughtered specifically Bitzafon in the north, and the ramp is specifically Bidarom in the south.
Now, if a woman is making the sacrifice, she's walking into the inner courtyard she's upstairs?
So in the second Beis HaMikdash, there was a special entrance for women. In the second Beis HaMikdash, remember, the way this is laid out is you have outer courtyard running in a really, we'll call it a semicircle, on three sides, surrounding the inner courtyard. So there seems to be no way to get there unless you're going to go through the outer courtyard. In the second Beis HaMikdash, it wasn't the case. The outer courtyard was to the east, and then the inner courtyard was to the west. And there, on the inner courtyard, there were entrances from the chatzer, from the outer area, that you could go directly from out here into the inner area. So the women, you have the picture over there from the.
This is the second.
Yeah. So, see, this would be the inner courtyard. This area here corresponds to this area here, the inner courtyard. The people would come through here to offer their sacrifices. Women would come through the gate over here if they had a sacrifice to bring. The balcony that's spoken about is here. That's where the balcony is. It's up over here. That on the Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkot, where the women would, that was all over here. If a woman had to bring a sacrifice, she would come through the side over here. So that way, there would be a special designated area for women, so you wouldn't have a mixture of men and women bringing sacrifices. I don't know where in the third Beis HaMikdash that would work. It doesn't seem like there's any place to have a specific area. Now, we already learned that there is a balcony. We've already learned about that. There's a balcony along the outer wall here. There is a balcony. So we know there's a balcony, but where does a woman go to offer sacrifices? I don't know. I don't know. It's one of those things that, again, this is all an approximation, and it is one of the drawbacks of having a diagram. When you have a diagram, your mind becomes fixed on a diagram and assumes that everything is going to be the way that the diagram says. But we have to allow in our minds for the very real possibility that some of this is not accurate. That's an approximation. Yeah.
In the vision, Hashem is speaking to the Ezekiel.
Right.
Right. Okay. And then who is? I'm asking this question because I've noticed something. Then who is leading him through the areas?
It's an angel. It's an angel.
Every time there's a lowercase h. So obviously Hashem is not taking him
correct.
Through.
Correct. It's an angel.
Who is the? It's an angel.
He has a tour guide.
Okay.
Right.
Well, that's what I just wanted to find out because everything was in lowercase.
Yeah. Yeah. That's correct.
So, on the three big holidays, there are thousands of people. They're all in the courtyard. What is it like? The women are up in the balcony. What do we see up in the balcony? What do we see? Did we see anything?
You saw everything. You see everything.
What do we see? Do we actually see the slaughtering of the animals? Can we see from there?
You can see better from there than from downstairs.
So we can see.
I want you to know that my daughters, that when we moved to Atlanta and they saw that there's a balcony in the kollel, they were so thrilled, because most shuls today don't have balconies. That's really an old style thing,
right,
to have balconies.
Right.
They love balconies because you can see so much more from upstairs than you can from downstairs. And especially one daughter in particular, since we're on the recording, I can't use names, but one daughter in particular who is definitely our Yenta, she absolutely loves balconies. She gets to see everything that's going on.
So we saw everything. We saw the Kohen Gadol come in, the exchange of animals.
Whatever you could see. I mean, whatever you want to see.
But how did people who were wheelchair bound or unable to go upstairs, how did they get there?
I don't know.
Nobody's going to.
I don't know.
This is the third base of Mikdash, and everybody's going to
be here. But you're asking about the second base of Mikdash. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to the question.
May I ask one more?
I'll tell you that on Shabbos, my daughter will start off on one, the balcony goes, on the kollel goes like in a semicircle also.
Yeah.
She starts off on one side, but then she makes her way around because she can't see directly under the balcony and she can't miss anything. So at some point during davening, she makes her way around so she can see what's going on underneath the other part of the balcony.
It's the best seat for Megillah reading, is the women's section.
Oh, the Megillah reading, yeah.
On the second temple, and the women are entering the side of the temple where it is closest to the sanctuary. I thought that was interesting that in the second temple, this one,
we don't. There doesn't seem to be a corresponding type. Yeah, so I don't know where it would be. In the second temple, they had a very practical entrance. It was great.
Yeah.
So here, I don't know. Doesn't talk about it.
Women won't have to bring a sacrifice.
Well, there are sacrifices that everybody has to bring at some point or other. You're not a sin offering, but
there. If you give birth, you have to bring a sacrifice.
And there are other things as well. There are different sacrifices that people bring. So,
Carbon Toda.
Yeah, Carbon Toda. Okay, but I guess we'll find out, Mirtasha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is it that when people would generally enter the Beis HaMikdash, they would have to enter in one entrance and then exit from the corresponding gate rather than the same one they came in? So Rashi explains, because we know that during the holidays, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, it says Yeira'eh Kol Zechurcha, all your males shall be seen in the Beis HaMikdash. So Rashi understands what that means is, what does it mean you'll be seen in the Beis HaMikdash? So the Gemara tells us you'll be seen by Hashem. Now, it doesn't mean that Hashem can't see you if you're not in the Beis HaMikdash, but it means that He will see you in the Beis HaMikdash. But the Rashi understands what that means is, you'll be seen thoroughly in the Beis HaMikdash. You'll be seen very well. Not just in one area of the Beis HaMikdash, but you'll make sure to be seen all over the Beis HaMikdash. That when you come in on the holiday, you come in through this entrance, and then you make your way through the entire Beis HaMikdash and exit the other side. And that way,
but you go straight across.
No, you can't go straight across. So you've got to, but you end up all over the place because you've got to go in one and not the other. And remember, there's a lot of people there. It's not like this wide open area. You just sprint from one side to the other. It's like the Beth Jacob Kiddush. You're trying to get from one end to the other. Try to go from one end of the room to the other end of the room. You're not going to be able to go on a beeline. You're going to have to like move this way and that way, and then you got to, and you go over to say hello to this person, say hello to that person, and then eventually you'll get to the other side of the room. So it takes you'll end up all over the room. So that's the idea during the Shalosh Regalim. And that's why the people have to go in one and out the other. So that's the first step. Yeah.
Were they allowed to talk while they were going through?
I think so. I think they could talk.
Barefoot. These men are coming with shoes on, right?
And animals.
They had the special.
And animals.
Okay. So, I'm seeing toes getting stepped on here.
Oh, boy.
I'm seeing a lot of noise between the animals and the men talking downstairs.
A lot of piles of
Yeah, that's why you have the dung gate, because somebody's got to move it over. You know, I'm just saying...
Is that true? Is that why it's called
the dung
gate?
I don't believe that's what it's called. But, the talking part, you're allowed to talk, but I imagine that they were careful what they said. They were in the Beis HaMikdash after all. I mean, you don't go talking about, you know,
the baseball game,
right. Right, let alone Lashon Hara.
That's only in the sermon.
That's right. Okay.
So the bracha that you say for people you've only, you know, seen after a
period of time,
they're saying those kind of brachas because they might not have seen these people in a year.
Right. Could be. Right. I'm sure there was a cacophony of sound. I'm sure. And you're right. And it was wild. There were animals. There were people. It was just. I'm sure there was a lot going on. I'm sure it was very, very happening, as they say. The Kohanim would have to watch their feet. But remember, they only have to be barefoot when they're serving, not when they're.
A lot of them are serving.
Yeah, but then they're in the inner courtyard. That's where they are.
Yeah, but people are walking through the inner
courtyard. Not where they're serving. Where they're serving, they're going to be beyond this demarcation line, and they're going to have these lines of Kohanim to the altar, so they could pass the.
So at that time, you can't go in the northern or southern gate.
Well,
you're past the demarcation.
Right, I'm not sure. That's like one of the things.
Then how would you come out a different door?
Yeah, I'm not.
Go all the way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It does not seem like
you can't go all the way around if you're past the line. Then if you have to stay behind the line, you only have one door.
Right. It does not seem from the picture that there's a way to go in or out that way. But again, I'm not sure.
That would make a good argument against those. Two bottom chambers.
Right. That's right. Because they really take up a lot of space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it's not clear to me all the details over here, but that is
so
the
you
idea.
You said that the people go in the northern and out the southern, which means that we're past the line of demarcation.
Yeah, but they could be doing this.
They go around. I don't think that's true.
I'm not sure. It may mean the northern and southern. May mean the outer gates of the northern and southern. Mm-hmm. Now. The Nasi, when he would come in when it wasn't on the holidays, so there was no need to be seen throughout the entire complex, so he could come in the east and go out the east. And since he would come regularly, whether he's the Kohen Gadol or the king, he would come regularly to the Beis HaMikdash, so therefore he had his own special way of going in and coming out. On the Yontif, then he would also go in through the north and come out through the south, or vice versa. Now, it should be noted that there is a halacha today. It's a halacha which is which we don't practice today because many shuls don't have double entrances, double ways. But if you have a shul that has an entrance in one area, another entrance in another area, then it is considered appropriate to go in one and exit the other. It's a way of showing deference and honor to the shul. To rather than just it's if you go in and come out the same gate, it's almost like, you know,
taking it for granted.
Well, no, it's almost like
seeing the whole thing.
It's like you go in, do what you have to do, and leave. You know, you're not there, you're not present.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you come in one and go out the other, so then you have to get through the entire complex. So in the main sanctuary upstairs, there really only is one main entrance. Of course, we do know there's the side entrances as well, but they're not main areas of entrance.
What about Heritage Hall versus the front door? Is that considered?
I don't know, because that's the ante room. That's not the sanctuary itself. I don't know that one has to be do that. One could argue that in the Kol based Medrash, where you have different. There's at least, depending on what's open and what's closed, there's at least three entrances and exits that you could go through. And then one could argue that one should do that if they entered through one, go out through the other one. And one could do that. The way that most shuls are built today, that you just don't have that system. It's not like in the Beis HaMikdash where you have primary entrances in three directions.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, the flow of traffic, you have a primary entrance only in one area, and then you have like fire exits and like that in other areas.
If the king is coming to the Beis HaMikdash and he's allowed to sit, where does he sit?
Well, he could sit wherever he wants.
As long as it's not the Kohanim's area, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, he could. Well, right. He could sit wherever he wants. That's the difference between the king and the other and everybody else. That is an argument to say that, by the way, that we're talking about the king and not the Kohen Gadol, because it says that he'll sit and eat. We've mentioned this back in Perek Mandam 44. So that's another thing. So there are a lot of unanswered questions here. Thankfully, it didn't already happen. It will happen. So the answers will be very clear, and hopefully we will see it very speedily. But we're getting the general idea of something that's going on over here. The idea of most people having to go through the sanctuary and being seen all throughout it.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
If the offerings were of a very specific kind, as it's stated, they were of a very specific kind, and so forth. Did they have to be salted?
Do we
salt meat now because we don't have that specific unblemished sacrifice?
No, salting the meat.
Salt at that time.
All the sacrifices had to be salted because there's a verse in the Torah that says you have to salt all the sacrifices. That's not why we salt meat today. We salt meat today because you can't make meat kosher without salting it.
Okay.
And that has nothing to do with
that answers the question.
That has to do with getting rid of the blood.
Yeah.
That's why it's salted to eat it. But in a carbon, a sacrifice, even the ones that are not eaten have to be salted. Because there's a special verse in the Torah that says you have to put salt on every sacrifice. Yeah.
You know that phrase that you said that people are seeing? I was wondering, because we had a different level of Kedusha, that Hashem saw us, like really saw us, that we have a good intention with the sacrifice,
uh-huh.
Well, we're really sorry that we bring, did we bring our best?
Okay.
Were we,
good. Like, he scrutinized us.
Yes.
Okay, that could be.
That's
right. Okay. Yud Aleph, Pasuk, Yud Aleph, verse 11. Uvachagim uvamoadim, and on the holidays and on the meeting times, tia hamincha efala parve efala ayo, then the mincha that you would bring, this is the flour offering that was brought along with the sacrifice. It was an epha for a bull and an epha for a ram. We already explained before that it wasn't really an epha, but that was the amount that you brought. Then you sifted the flour and got it down to the correct amount. And for the sheep, the gift of your hand, v'shemen hin la'efa, and oil a hin per epha. Again, it wasn't really a hin; it was less than a hin, but the hin was the measuring cup. And when the nasi would make a voluntary offering, Ola Oshlamim, either a totally burnt offering or a peace offering, Nidavala Hashem as a gift to Hashem, Ufasach Lomas Hashar Haponek Kadim. They would open for him the gate that faced the east. Va'asa Esalosa Ves Shlamav, and he would make his burnt offering and his peace offering. Kasher Yasa Biyom HaShabbos, the same way that was done on regular Shabbos. In other words, even if it was during the week, they would do this. They would open up the gate for him. But in this case, V'yatzah, he would leave. V'sagaras HaShar Achrei Tzeiso, and he would close the gate after he left. They would not leave it open as they did on Shabbos and on Rosh Chodesh, where they left it open so the people who passed by could bow. Here, they would close it immediately because during the week it was not common to have that many people in the Beis HaMikdash. And a sheep that was a year old, that was unblemished, would be made as an ola daily to Hashem. This is the carbon tamid, this is referring to the daily offering. Baboker, baboker, ta'aseh, so each morning it was done. Umincha sa'aseh, olav, baboker, baboker, and a mincha, a flower offering, was done along with it. Every single morning, shishis ha'efa, a sixth of an efa, v'shemen shlishis ha'hin, an oil, a third of a hin, laros es ha'soles, to mix the flour, mincha la'Hashem, it was a flour offering for Hashem, chukos olam tamid, a statute forever. Now, this term, a sixth of an epha, is difficult because the amount that you would actually bring would be a tenth of an epha. that was brought. So a sixth of an ephah is a little bit difficult to understand. So the Gemara does some rather complicated math over here to make it work out, which I will share with you, and don't be discouraged if it's not so clear. But essentially, the Gemara points out that the measuring sizes, as we showed before, were increased. They were increased by a sixth. And so a sixth of an ephah in the new measuring size was actually a fifth of an ephah in the old measuring size. And a fifth of an ephah would be two-tenths. One-tenth was brought as the flour offering that went along with the Karban Tamid. The other tenth was used for the special flour offering that the Kohen Gadol has to bring every day. The Kohen Gadol has to bring a special flour offering called the Chavitin, which were brought each day by the Kohen Gadol, half in the morning and half in the afternoon. And so this is a reference to that flour offering as well.
So when it says here, you are to bring, da da da, it means the Kohen Gadol?
Yeah, now it's funny because the Karban Tamid was not brought by the Kohen Gadol necessarily. It could be brought by any Kohen. But it seems that the Kohen Gadol was in charge to make sure that it happened. And so it's being put on his head. He's the buck stops with him. He's going to make sure it takes place. Yasu, Pasuk Tezvav, verse 15. Yasu es hakeves ves hamincha ves hashemen baboker baboker. They should make the sheep and the flour offering and the oil each morning, olas tamid, a consistent carbon. Ko amar Hashem Elokim. So says Hashem God. Now here we move away from carbonos for a moment, and we're going to move into the portion, the land that the Nasi had, that the king had in Eretz Yisrael. Remember we pointed out that in Eretz Yisrael, in the future, that there's going to be land. We're going to get back to this later on in Perek Mem Zion. We're going to get into this again, but that, or maybe it's Mem Ches. One of the last two prakim, we're going to get to this again. That in Eretz Yisrael, the way the land is going to be divided up in the future will be strips of land that will be one per tribe, and there's going to be one in the middle. A 13th strip of land. Each strip is a very, very large strip of land. This 13th strip, which is going to be in the middle, will be partially designated for the Beis HaMikdash and for the Kohanim and for the Levium. And then the balance of that land will be given to the king, and he can use it for his purposes. So now we are going back to that land for a moment and saying as follows.
What does he need with so much land?
Well, what does anybody need so much land for? Right?
Right.
It seems that he will not have to tax the people because he will have this land.
Oh.
And that's what we're going to see right now.
Okay.
Kamar Hashem Elokim says is Hashem God. Ki itena nasi matana li'ish mi banav. When the nasi will give a gift to one of his children, meaning of land, nachala sohi, it is his possession, live on avtiyah, will go to his children. It is their possession in their inheritance for the land. So he can give it to his children. But if he gives some a gift of his possessions, of his land, to one of his servants, then it will only be owned by that servant until the year of freedom. What's the year of freedom?
Yovel.
Vishavas la nasi, then it will be returned to the nasi every 50 years. Ach nachalaso banav lahem tiyeh. Rather, his portion, his possessions will be for his children. Now, as a result of that, v'lo yikach ha-nasi minachalas ha'am, the nasi will not take from the possessions of the nation. Lahono sam me'achuza sam to. Now, lahono sam could mean to
make them suffer.
Make them suffer, right? To take away their things, from their possessions. Me'achuza so yanchilas banav. Rather, from his own possessions, he'll give to his children. Lamana shalafutzu ami, so that my nation should not be dispersed. Ish me'achuza so, each man from his possession, from his land. So what is being said is that in the past, in the first Beis HaMikdash, the king would take land that belonged to other people. This was not illegal because the king has sweeping powers. Remember that when the people asked for a king, Shmuel HaNavi told them, you have to understand the king has sweeping powers. If you're asking for a king, he's a monarch, and you cannot limit his power. And he can take your land, he can take your children, he can take your boys and put them in the army, he can take your daughters and put them in his household to run his household, and you can't stop him. And he has sweeping power. And they wanted it anyway, and that was put in place. Now, by and large, the kings were righteous, at least in Yehuda, right. There were some evil kings. By and large, they were righteous, and the righteous kings did not abuse their power. Nevertheless, there were times when they needed to take land, and they did. If they had to build a road, it wasn't like today where the government if they want to build a road, so they can take your land, but they have to pay you, right?
Yeah.
No, they have to pay you. The king would not have to pay. If he wanted to take land, he could just take the land. The righteous kings would pay if they were taking somebody's land. They wouldn't just throw someone off their land, but theoretically, the monarch has sweeping power and could take as he chooses. As long as it's justifiably needed for the good of the people. And then he could do it. If there was a border town and needed fortification, and your farm happened to be the area that needed to have a special fortified wall built, then he would take part of your land and build the wall. Whatever it was that had to be done, he could take people's land, he could take people's possessions. Here, we're being told that in the future, the king is going to have such a large area that will be considered his, a huge, huge, huge area of land, there will be no need for him to commandeer anybody else's land. Now, what about the reasons I said before, building a road, or for protection, etc.? So theoretically, that could happen, but it would not happen for the needs, for the financial needs of the country. Because for the financial needs of the country, for taxation purposes, the king has this massive area, which essentially is the public, it's for the public need. Not that the public has control over, the king does. But this way, he has the land which he can use to finance whatever has to be done in the country. Yeah.
Do the daughters of the king have to marry in Shevet Yehuda? So if they are gifted land and it's theirs, and they marry someone from another Shevet, how does that work?
Yeah, so theoretically it should work the same as it would with anybody if their daughters get land. Remember that the way it's supposed to work, according to the Torah, is that only the males inherit the land. And that way the land does not move from one tribe to another. However, if there are no sons, only daughters, as we know from the daughters of Tzelafchad in the Torah, which is coming up actually fairly soon, in a couple of weeks we'll get to the daughters of Tzelafchad. So they got land, and then there were no boys to inherit the land, and they got it. So then the leaders of the tribe of Manasseh, which was the tribe that they were from, came to Moshe and said, but now if they marry out of our tribe, which is permitted, then they will take the land with them, and then our tribe loses the land. So Moshe asked Hashem, and Hashem said that it's a valid point, and therefore in the first generation, when the Jews entered the land of Israel, they would not be allowed, any woman who inherited land would not be allowed to marry outside of her tribe. She had to find a husband inside her tribe. That was only though for the first generation. After the first generation in Israel, then anybody could marry wherever they wanted, and then the land would move. Now, what's the value of only doing this for one generation? If the whole point is that the land should not move from one area to another, so then what's the point of only doing this for one generation? If it's important, then do it forever, and if it's not important, then who cares about the first generation? So one of my one of my colleagues in yeshiva many years ago. We once investigated this and thought it through. And our conclusion was that it's important at the outset, when the tribes first came to Israel, where they were establishing themselves on their land, the Torah recognizes a special connection between people and their land. That it's hard for us to relate to this because we're not agricultural in nature. We don't have an agricultural society. But that the land and the person connect very intimately. And we understand that Eretz Yisrael is not just a nice place to live. It's actually a place that is particularly suited for us Jews. And not only is it particularly suited for us Jews, it's each part of the land is particularly suited for a particular tribe. This area is best for Yehuda. This area is best for Shimon. This area is best for Reuven. That's the way that the land is set up. So when the tribes first came and they were there, it seems that the first generation were, shall we say, initiating the land. They were imbuing their land with their particular, with that tribe's particular strengths were being injected into the land. That took one generation's time. Once that generation passed away and the next generation took over, then there was no need for that rigidity. The land, Reuven's land, would forever be Reuven's, even if another tribe got a hold of it. It was still Reuven's land. Reuven had injected into the land what Reuven stands for. Shimon's land was forever Shimon's land. Now, I don't know if that system will repeat itself with the third Beis HaMikdash. I don't know if there will be any kind of restriction in the third Beis HaMikdash for the tribes only marrying within each other. We don't know what tribes we're from. Unless you're fortunate enough to be from Levi or a Kohen, we don't know what tribes we're from. So when we find out, it's likely we're going to find out that not only we'll find out where we're from, but most likely there are a lot of marriages which are cross tribes, almost for sure. Now that's not a problem because it follows the husband.
What happens with today, so many intermarriages, you know?
Well, intermarriage is a whole separate problem. So
where Gerim go?
Gerim don't have land. That's one of the challenges of a ger. That's one of the reasons. It's one of the ways of discouraging a convert to make sure that they're sincere. Is that, you know, a convert doesn't have land. That is one of the challenges. So and remember, none of us really know. Going back, I mean, you're from a Levi, but your sister's from a Levi, right? None of us really know going back whether we're descendants of converts. We might be. So none of us can really say, you know, we may know that we're not converts, but we may not know going back how far back we go. And if we're descendants of converts, then we don't have any land either. So we don't know.
That's where the blasphemer came in.
That's what?
You didn't have the land.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
She's talking about.
Right.
He didn't have any land.
Robertson Feldman. Right, he didn't have any land. That's correct.
We'll coordinate all of our classes together.
Right, so unless we know if we're Cohen or Levi, then we're probably not.
Do we have an idea when the third base of it gets built, what the land's going to look like?
No.
What the borders are
going to be? We don't know. We know it's going to be a lot larger than it is today, and we know that not only will it be larger, but the land itself will expand. And not only will the borders be further than they are today, but the land itself will expand. And
the king has so much land. I mean, Israel isn't that big.
Yeah.
So much land. What does that mean?
He only has 1/13. I mean, there's plenty of other land over there. But we don't know what it's going to look like. There's going to be geographical, topographical changes, geological changes.
In Eretz Yisrael
and there's no way to guess.
I was going to say it's going to go all the way to the Tigris and Euphrates.
Yeah, but...
Then you're in Iraq.
Yeah, but we don't have... Yeah, no, it will. It'll certainly go into Syria and into Jordan, possibly partially Egypt, partially, it's certainly Lebanon, but maybe even into Iraq. There's no way to really know.
We'll have to find out soon.
But
right.
Can we guess? Do we have a vague idea?
We have vague ideas, but a lot of it is speculation. So we don't know. Now, this pasuk we just read ends the Haftorah for Parshas HaChodesh. Remember I told you that before Pesach, Parshas HaChodesh, this is the Haftorah for it. And it ends with this pasuk with Pasuk Yud Ches, verse 18. So next time, when we start Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19, that is no longer in the Haftorah. We're moving along over here. I was thinking that we'd be able to finish Yechezkel in the summertime, but before the Kol takes our break. We take our break at the end of July. So we have really two more months, which is a lot of time to finish. But I don't know if the Bina schedule is going to conflict with our Yechezkel class. If it does conflict, then we'll defer to the Bina class, and then we'll finish it, Mirza Shem and Elul, before, around the time of the Yom Tov.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.